Chapter 3 of the syllabus looks at the regulation of financial markets and institutions, both at the European Union level through such strictures as MiFID, which we looked at earlier on, the Markets in Financial Instruments Directive, and at the United Kingdom level, where you've got the regulation of, for example, the Prudential Regulatory Authority, but most importantly, the FCA. The Financial Conduct Authority. So first we're going to look at the European Union directives. So as we saw before, the most important form of regulation by the European Union is in the form of these directives. We'll then look at the UK regulatory structure and spend time in particular looking at the role of the Financial Conduct Authority. We'll look at the regulation of investment exchanges, the London Stock Exchange for example, and how they're regulated, as well as others such as multilateral trading facilities. We'll look at the FCA's business standards, what it expects from the firms and individuals that are operating within the United Kingdom, and we'll look at the supervision and redress measures that are available in the regulatory environment. Finally, we'll look at financial crime. Financial crime, main two areas are in fact in terms of money laundering and in terms of insider dealing, where we've got more information than particularly retail investors and therefore have an unfair advantage. So section one looks at the European Union directives, regulation and guidance. So this really falls underneath the Financial Services Action Plan, FSAP, which is really there to create greater harmonisation within the European Union in terms of creating a single market. Of course, economically, the European Union is there to create a single market in all kinds of goods and services. And this is, of course, relating to financial services within the European Union. So the key objective is to create a single market, to achieve open and secure retail markets, so where products are available for investment by retail investors outside of a country's domicile, to give retail investors a wider choice, and to give firms greater access to more investors and therefore potential to generate more business. And also finally to create state-of-the-art prudential rules and structures of supervision, really to create a more stable investment environment. Again, to encourage the flow of capital from savers, those with surplus funds, to investment capital formation within firms, to promote economic growth within the European Union. So main directives of interest are the Market Abuse Directive, so looking to avoid situations where certain actors abuse the market, where we've seen, for example, the manipulation of the LIBOR rate by certain traders in London and elsewhere, and of course the fixing of foreign exchange and gold. Secondly, the Prospectus Directive. So this is where the guidelines are laid down for the standards required of prospectuses issued in the European Union. Very importantly, the MiFID, the Markets in Financial Instruments Directive, plays a central role in terms of how markets should be conducted. And then finally, the Alternative Investment Fund Managers Directive. This, of course, chiefly aimed at hedge funds as well as private equity fund managers. So the European Systematic Risk Board really is looking across the financial sector and works closely with three new European supervisory authorities. The main one of concern to us is the European Securities and Markets Authority, ESMA, and the key there, of course, is to ensure integrity, transparency and the orderly functioning of securities markets within Europe. In conjunction with that, the banking market is supervised by the European Banking Authority, and separately from that, the Insurance and Occupational Pensions Authority looks at those particular markets. So, EU directives, as we looked at already, are the most important form of European law, particularly as they apply to financial services, and can be implemented either by primary legislation, so where the EU directives themselves stipulate what needs to happen within a particular jurisdiction, or through delegated legislation. So here, statutes within an existing European Union country only need to be amended to the extent that it's necessary to implement the directive. So if the statutes are pretty much already there in terms of their legal content and form, then only minor changes are needed rather than a wholesale adoption of EU laws. So in terms of how the EU directives affect the United Kingdom, so where we've got situations where a member state and companies within the European Union, so here we've got an interaction, of course, between a member state, so for example the United Kingdom and a particular company. So here we have what's called a vertical direct effect. So the provisions of the directive, i.e. EU law, should prevail over national law in that case. Where we're looking at situations between two companies, however, there's a horizontal direct effect. So the directive doesn't take precedence in this case, but national courts should ensure that the spirit of the directive is adopted in any judgments that are given, but with the basis really in local national law, so UK law there being used as the basis. So MiFID, the Markets in Financial Instruments Directive, by far and away the most important single piece of legislation, really has as its chief goal this single market in financial services throughout the European Union. So the mechanism for this is a single authorization, or a passport as it's called. So the idea here is that if a product has been approved within a particular EU member state, then it should be then available within other states within the European Union. So this was really adopted in the UK in November 2007 and replacing the previous Investment Services Directive. So in particular, the MiFID requirements here upgraded advice that could be provided on a standalone basis relating to an investment service, also included multilateral trading facilities such as that operated by individual companies in competition, of course, with the likes of the London Stock Exchange. And so this became part of the passporting service, that if you had an MTF, a multilateral trading facility, set up in one European jurisdiction, it could be offered automatically in others via the passporting system. Passporting system was also extended to include commodity derivatives, credit derivatives such as credit default swaps, and also financial CFDs, contracts for differences. So the idea, as we've mentioned, is to facilitate the cross-border business expansion by investment firms within the European Union. So importantly, MiFID distinguishes between key investment services and ancillary services, services that go with other core investment services. So the main investment services include the reception and transmission of orders, execution, market making and principal dealing, managing investment portfolios, making recommendations, placing financial instruments, so these are private placements, for example, of equities or bonds, any underwriting activities, or indeed the operation of a multilateral trading facility. So those are the mainstream activities which are subject to MiFID rules. The ancillary services include safekeeping, the custody of financial instruments for clients, any kind of credit, so loans being made to investors, for example, any advisory work or foreign exchange services, any investment research and general recommendations not relating to investment advice, or indeed any underwriting related services. So if a firm is only providing these ancillary services, then it doesn't need to be MiFID compliant. However, if it does provide these core investment services, then any ancillary services that it also provides are also subject to MiFID. So that's quite an important point made there. So UCITS is the Undertakings for Collective Investments in Transferable Securities. So these are fund types of products, collective investment schemes that enable multiple investors to get access to a common portfolio. So this is mutual fund type of business here. So the directives are, the UCITS 3 is split into two parts, a management directive, so this is concerning the management of the funds themselves, and also the product directive, separately there, the structure of the product being offered itself. So the management directive, it goes with the passported activity, including here discretionary management, safekeeping, fund administration, those ancillary services as we saw before. So that's to do with the management of money, and the product directive, to do with the investment products and the structures that they offered, was expanded to include derivative investments and derivatives for risk management, interest rate swaps, that type of instrument were part of the UCITS 3 directive. UCITS 4 developed further to passport management companies themselves. It established a procedure for cross-border fund mergers and introduced a master feeder structure. So this is where you have one fund at the master level and various feeders there. So you could have, for example, one master fund based in Luxembourg, for example, and then several feeder funds based in, for example, the UK, one in France, for example, perhaps one in Germany, and then another one perhaps in Spain. So you've got one master, so one single fund, which is a collective for the overall portfolio, but then several products which are tailored to the local market. So UCITS 4 is still awaited currently, so UCITS 5 is being prepared. UCITS 4 is the latest version of this. Now EMIR, or the European Market Infrastructure Regulation, is really covering over-the-counter derivatives, so the likes of interest rate swaps, for example, are one of the largest over-the-counter markets. But where they're cleared through a central counterparty within the European Union. So it relates to the clearing of certain types of OTC, over-the-counter derivatives, through a central counterparty, and also puts in place risk management requirements where OTC derivatives are not cleared through a central counterparty. Also importantly, it requires that derivatives are reported to a centralized trade repository. Section 2 looks specifically at UK regulation of financial services. And really one of the major changes in recent times was the change from the Financial Services Authority and up until the 31st of March 2013, and on the 1st of April of that year, really the responsibilities of the Financial Services Authority were broken into three areas. Really, the financial conduct, the Financial Services Authority had too broad an ambit for its regulatory reach. So it was broken up into, in fact, three areas: a new macroprudential regulator, the Financial Policy Committee. This is actually a department or a committee of the Bank of England, chaired in fact by Mark Carney, the Bank of England governor. So they're really looking at the big picture here at the moment, looking at banks' exposures to, for example, emerging markets and other areas that might create risk across the system. Responsibility for systemically important firms, such as the major banks in the United Kingdom, like Barclays Capital, for example, and other large operators, such as JP Morgan Chase, etc. This was transferred to the Prudential Regulation Authority, the PRA. From an investment services point of view, the Financial Conduct Authority is really one of the most important regulators on a day-to-day basis for investment services firms. So the new structure really coming under the overall supervision of the Bank of England. The Financial Policy Committee is a direct department of the Bank of England itself. So the key objective there is to enhance the stability of the system by reducing systematic risk within the overall system. So the Prudential Regulatory Authority, the PRA, the idea there is that they directly regulate PRA authorised persons, and particularly those that are systemically important, those large banks, as we mentioned before. Also, the Bank of England directly supervises the systematic infrastructure, such as the central clearing houses, so the central counterparties, such as the LCH ClearNet organisation, and also any settlement systems as well, so ensuring that there's no difficulties there with settlements, which might lead to a loss of confidence in the overall system. The FCA directly regulates investment firms and exchanges, plus other financial service providers, such as dealers and broker-dealers in the markets. And the FCA also looks after the deposit takers, so protecting retail depositors there, and it shares responsibility in some organisations with the Prudential Regulatory Authority. So there's an overlap there between those two regulators. So the UK regulatory structure as it stands now really was trying to plug the gap of not really having a single body with responsibility for monitoring the stability of the financial system as a whole. So that's really the role of the Financial Policy Committee, part of the Bank of England, directly to provide that sort of overall monitoring process. So the FPC meets at least quarterly in order to monitor the risks within the overall system. The PRA and the Financial Conduct Authority directly regulate firms. So rather than taking a step back and looking at the overall system, which the FPC does, the PRA, the Prudential Regulation Authority, and the Financial Conduct Authority directly regulate firms. So looking at the PRA, the Prudential Regulation Authority, first of all, so this really complements the role of the Financial Policy Committee, obviously looking at the organisations on the ground, how they're operating, and really promoting the safety and soundness of the firms that it regulates, of course, reporting back to the Financial Policy Committee if it finds areas that it may be of concern in terms of the overall stability of the system. So the PRA really combines regulatory policy with resolution of firms' issues when they fail and can impose intensive supervision if they feel it's required. Here the senior expert teams will step in and will make judgments regarding the viability of financial firms going forward in the future. The scope of the FCA, the Financial Conduct Authority, really falls into three operational categories. First and foremost, securing an appropriate degree of protection for consumers, particularly here, of course, our retail investors, ensuring that they're confident within the system, that retail depositors are confident enough in the banking system and the service they provide. Also, promoting efficiency and choice in the market, so ensuring that retail investors have a sufficient degree of choice in terms of the products and services that they can buy. And also, critically, protecting and enhancing the integrity of the UK financial system as a whole, because of course of its huge importance in the UK economy. So the key areas, the scope of FCA's activities, include the conduct of all firms in terms of their business throughout the both retail and wholesale markets. So this is where retail activity involves selling products, for example, to retail investors, whereas wholesale activities involve trading in international markets. So also it takes a role as the lead regulator for all firms that were previously regulated by the Financial Services Authority. And also it plays a key role in regulatory oversight of client assets. So firms have a fiduciary duty, investment firms have a legal duty to properly look after client assets. And as we'll see in a second, countering financial crime, particularly there, as I mentioned, financial crime typically covers money laundering and also insider dealing, importantly. So that all comes under the FCA's ambit of supervision. So all of the market regulation activities carried out by the FCA were taken over by the Financial Conduct Authority, apart from the responsibilities for settlement systems and the recognised clearinghouses, like, for example, the LCH ClearNet. That's now been transferred directly to the Bank of England, who feel that it's a systemically important type of function. So also the FCA inherited the responsibilities for those organisations operating outside of the Financial Services Markets Authority, that's the FSMA Act of 2000. So this includes e-money firms, it includes payment service providers and mutual societies. Now the overlap that I mentioned before means that in fact you can find yourself as an investment firm being regulated by both the Prudential Regulatory Authority and the Financial Conduct Authority. So the idea behind having these dual regulated idea, so the rules are that the PRA functions will be expanded to cover any FCA functions where there is overlap. So here we're kind of mapping on the PRA functions onto those of the FCA to avoid having excessive amounts of regulatory overhead. One of the new innovations in the last couple of years has been the advent of the Competition and Markets Authority, the CMA, which controls merger and acquisition in the United Kingdom, i.e. where one firm may be taking over another. So this applies, so the CMA will get involved where the target firm, of course there's an acquiring firm and a target firm, so where the target firm has a turnover within the United Kingdom of greater than £70 million, then the CMA, the Competition and Markets Authority, will get involved. And also from the point of view of promoting competition, where the proposed new merged company would then supply over 25% of the goods or services within a given market. At that point, the CMA would get involved. So the CMA will take responsibility for that only in exceptional circumstances. For example, in the interests of national defence, for example, will the Secretary of State at the Department for Business, Innovation and Skills intervene and take decisions in place of the CMA. So really that's the only exception, is where we've got national defence issues at hand. So the history really of UK merger policy started with the Monopolies and Mergers Act in 1965, then developed by the Fair Trading Act of 1973, and then the Competition Act of 1998 created the Competition Commission and the Office of Fair Trading. These two organisations were then replaced, in fact, in 2013 by the Competitions and Mergers Authority in that year. Now, separately to the CMA, we have the Panel on Takeovers and Mergers. So this is a city organisation which is there to look after the interests of shareholders, to ensure that shareholders, both those on the acquiring and the target firms, are looked after fairly. So here they're responsible for operating and enforcing the City Code on Takeovers and Mergers, also known as the Takeover Code. So this organisation is in fact financed by a levy on share transactions. So when you buy a security in the United Kingdom, there's a small levy which helps to pay for this panel. So the role really of the Panel on Takeovers and Mergers is to ensure fair conduct in the takeover situations there, as I say, mainly to ensure that shareholders are treated fairly. So it doesn't actually have a force of law behind it, but it does have a legal framework that supports the panel's decisions. So this is actually established by the Competition Act of 1998. The Information Commissioner is there to enforce the stipulations of the Data Protection Act of 1998. So where investment firms are holding data relating to their clients, they have to follow 8 principles. Firstly, that the data is fairly and lawfully processed, that it's only used for the reasonable purposes of the organisation that has it, that it's adequate, relevant, not excessive to the requirements that a firm might have, that it's kept up to date and is accurate, is not kept any longer than is necessary, is processed in line with an individual's rights, is kept securely, of course, and is not transferred to other countries without adequate protection. So this is all protected by various laws, in fact, so fines can be imposed up to £500,000, and individuals can request access to the information being held by about them by any firm and organisation. Those firms can't charge any more than £10 for access to that data. So one of the most important pieces of legislation in recent times is the Financial Services and Markets Act, FSMA of 2000, was modified a little bit by the Financial Services Act of 2012, and this now provides the main framework for regulation of investment business in the United Kingdom. So if you want to undertake investment business in the United Kingdom, you have to be an authorised person under the stipulations of this Act. So there's two forms of authorisation. Part 4A permission, as it's called, which you can get by applying to the Financial Conduct Authority, or you can be passported in. So again, this is where the European Union laws come in, and you can be passported in if you have met the requirements of your own local authority. You can be directly passported in and approved for UK business. So what determines whether authorisation is required? So firstly, are the investments themselves falling under regulation? So any kind of investment products relating to securities, most derivatives for example, fall under the regulatory ambit of the FSMA 2000. Whether the activity relating to that investment is regulated, so for example any investment advice would be a regulated activity relating to any kind of investment. And thirdly, is there an exemption available? So here we look at exempted persons, not just natural persons like individuals, but also persons can be legal persons, which includes companies. So these can include appointed representatives, people representing an authorised person, an authorised firm in other words, any recognised investment exchanges, members of other professions, where this activity is incidental to normal business, so where you might have professional services provided to an investment firm or to a client, that's incidental to the process of business, and also members of the Lloyd's Insurance Syndicate are also automatically exempted. So in terms of the specified regulated investments, so all of these that are listed here are defined as investments by the FSMA Act. This includes physical investments, so it excludes land and property, where that property is held for private purposes, any antiques, and physical commodities. So commodities that are traded via derivatives such as futures do fall under the regulatory ambit of FSMA, but physical commodities do not. All of these others do, so deposits, any kind of electronic money. Insurance, importantly, both general insurance as well as life insurance are qualified, in fact, as regulated investments. Shares in companies, any debt instruments such as bonds, for example, any warrants or options, the rights to buy in particular types of investments or securities in the future, any certificates of ownerships such as depository receipts, for example, i.e. those instruments that give you a claim on shares listed on other exchanges, any collective investment schemes such as unit trusts, open-ended investment companies, any pension rights, any derivatives as investments. So we're distinguishing here, so derivatives used as investments fall under the regulatory ambit, but not where we're using a derivative for hedging. So for example, where British Airways is using a Brent crude oil future to hedge its requirements for fuel in the future, that doesn't count as an investment, that counts as a hedging tool. Any Lloyd's activities fall under the ambit of it, any rights under funeral plans, etc., and any rights that one might have or any interest in any kind of investment products, all fall within the specified regulatory ambit. In terms of the activities, really everything that one might expect relating to banking or investment product provision, which are all listed here. So this is actually specified as part of the FSMA 2000 regulations under the Regulated Activities Order of 2001, in fact. So this includes, of course, banks accepting deposits or issuing electronic money, making loans, for example, any contracts of insurance where you're acting as principal, importantly, any dealing in investments, any arrangement of deals in investments, so for example, home finance transactions or mortgages, managing investments, so managing pension funds, for example, or private client portfolios, where you've got discretion over the direction of funds, all come under the regulated activities. If you're operating an MTF, a multilateral trading facility, any custody or settlements activities all fall underneath it. Any sending of dematerialized instructions, for example, electronic transfer of title via CREST. Any management or running of collective investment schemes or pension schemes, etc. Where we're advising on stakeholder pensions, advising on investments. Any arrangement of mortgages, home plans, etc. Certain activities on the Lloyd's of London insurance certificate, providing funeral plans counts as an investment activity, or indeed agreeing to do any of the above, all fall under a regulated activity. So in terms of controlled activities, this includes the financial promotions. So the Financial Promotion Order of 2005. So here we're not allowed to promote or market a particular financial product in the course of our business unless it's been approved by an authorised person or indeed is subject to an exemption under the FPO law. So what is a financial promotion? Well, it's really any communication seeking to persuade individuals or companies to engage in an investment activity. So where this is a controlled activity, such as stakeholder pensions, investments of any kind, any insurance or mortgage type of situation, all fall within a financial promotion. So where it's for enticing people to engage in an investment activity. So importantly, it's a criminal offence, in fact, under FSMA for someone to say that they're authorised or exempt when indeed they are not. So the FCA has strict rules really on the different functions played by firms within an organisation. So if you are engaging in investment activity or investment business, you have a series of rules that you have to follow with regard to the FCA. So one of these is the Systems and Controls Arrangements, SYSC. So the overall objective of this really is to ensure that firms' directors engaged in investment business have the right level of responsibility and, frankly, the ability to manage a business. So looking to ensure that firms can organise and control their affairs in a sensible way, to encourage them to set up a proper organisation, to have the right skills in place for directors and managers, and also to ensure across the board that they have a sufficient platform really to comply with the Capital Requirement Directive and of course the European rules, the MiFID rules, Markets in Financial Instruments Directive. So ensuring really that the correct infrastructure is in place to comply with those requirements. So there are several stipulations here in different chapters to do with the general organisation of the firm. ensuring that employees, agents and other people concerned with the business have an appropriate level of skills. Also, that there are the right compliance arrangements in place, and that we have separate risk management functions that are appropriate to a particular type of business. It goes on to look at outsourcing, so where you're outsourcing particular functions. For example, if you're outsourcing your custody or settlement, you have to ensure that the providers of that service are competent in doing so. A very important area is this of record keeping. So in relation to any MiFID business, this is an important point which often comes up in the exam, you must keep your records for at least 5 years. Conflicts of interest need to be written down and recorded where there's any conflicts of interest that apply. Sometimes it's impossible to avoid conflicts of interest, but any that arise must be carefully documented by the firm. And risk management and prudential requirements also need to be carefully managed, particularly in relation to liquidity risk, ensuring that liquid funds can be made available when necessary. Operational risk, so for example here, ensuring that fraud doesn't take place, for example. Any group risk relating to the overall group of companies. Credit risk, of course, default risk on any type of investment that we have in place. Market risk, where we've got excessive exposure to the overall market, and of course where we're providing insurance. Whistleblowing, actually very importantly, is part of this regulatory ambit. Very important that firms do not act against the interests of whistleblowers. So the FCA is particularly keen to ensure that if firms are contravening rules, that whistleblowers can actually alert them to it. So in terms of financial crime and money laundering, the money laundering risk is where we've got potential for the proceeds of crime to be filtered through the system. So the FCA here is guided by the Joint Money Laundering Steering Group in this regard. So importantly, firms need to ensure that there's appropriate training for employees, that sufficient information is provided to the governing body and to senior management, that the risk management policies relating to money laundering are properly documented, that the money laundering operational protection is engineered into our day-to-day operational framework, and also the identification of new customers. So ensure that we have, for example, Know Your Client or KYC procedures in place to ensure that we can identify new customers and also track back to see where the funds have come from. That's an important point. Firms must have a money laundering reporting officer appointed within the organisation. So this person is the point man, really, for money laundering purposes. The Trustee Act 2000 specifies that an investment policy may lie with the trustees. So the key point here really is that the Act provides guidance in cases where a deed doesn't specify an investment policy. So the key stipulations here is that the investments must be suitable for the trust, so the suitability there is important, as well as for individual clients. It also applies to trusts here. So a trust, of course, is where money is being held on behalf of beneficiaries by a trustee. So really the same rules apply as they would for retail clients, where we've got money being held in a trust, and the portfolio, as with any other type of client, the portfolio must display adequate diversification. In other words, risk must be managed in a sensible way. With pension funds, The advantages really of a private occupational pension scheme include the fact that the employer's contribution isn't taxed. There are tax advantages here, and also for the employees as well, who receive income tax relief on their own contributions. The pension fund is exempt from capital gains tax on disposal of investments and is not subject to inheritance tax for discretionary trusts. So quite a lot of tax advantages here from pension fund structures. So normally pension funds themselves are administered by trustees outside of the firm rather than the employer themselves. So the legislation here is the Pensions Act of 2004. So the pensions regulator is there to protect the members or the beneficiaries of work-based schemes. So the key point there is that there's good administration of the regulated schemes. There is a Pension Protection Fund, or PPF, which provides some protection for the beneficiaries if there are insufficient funds within their employer's pension scheme. So every scheme must examine its funding ability through the scheme-specific funding requirement stipulations. That must be reviewed every 3 years and prepare a statement of funding principles, prepare a schedule of contributions, and also to prepare a recovery plan if the fund is significantly underfunded. So if the fund that's there to provide the pension doesn't have sufficient assets to meet its expected pension liabilities in the future, it has to prepare a plan for how it's going to catch up with those liabilities in the future. Also, a statement of investment principles must be prepared and produced by the trustees, which shows the risk management policy and also the various mandate stipulations that they've put in place for the fund. Section 3 looks at the objectives and high-level standards that are set down by the Financial Conduct Authority, the FCA, for the conduct of business by firms and the individuals that work within them. So the FCA's handbook, in terms of its guidelines here, is broken down into different blocks. So in fact, the original Financial Services Authority handbook was split between the FCA and the PRA and includes the following blocks. Block 1 relates to high-level standards. So these are the senior management arrangements we just looked at, SYSC. The authorisation standards, COND, so the conditions, in other words, under which we can operate in the United Kingdom. Statements of Principles for Business, PRIN. The Code of Practice for Approved Persons, APER. And the Fit and Proper criteria for approved persons. Block 3 relates to business standards, so conduct of business rules, training and competence, code of market conduct, and also the rules for the management of client assets and money. So for example, ensuring that appropriate custody arrangements are made for clients' assets. So the regulatory process really relating there to the relationship between the firm and the supervisor, the FCA, and also what goes on in terms of decision processes and procedures and any penalties that the FCA might put in, that all falls within Block 4 of the FCA handbook. Block 5 looks at redress, so how are any complaints resolved within the system, what are the measures that can be put in place? This comes under DISP in terms of the disputes or complaints procedure, and also what compensation potentially complainants could have access to. Block 6 looks at the regulatory guides, the enforcement guide for example, so what powers, in other words, the FCA has in terms of dealing with firms within the system. So authorization firms, as we looked at, part four permission is required from the FCA. So importantly here, you only need part 4A once. So importantly, the following threshold conditions must be satisfied in terms of your appropriate legal status, that the registered office and head office are in the same country. So the structure of the firm mustn't inhibit supervision, effective supervision by the regulator, that a firm has appropriate resources at its disposal to conduct its business in a reasonable way so that it can employ people with the right levels of skills, that it has the right ICT infrastructure in place, etc. That the fitness and propriety of the applicants, so again ensuring here that we haven't got any criminal records with the directors within the organisation, and also the FCA will look at the business model of the firm to see that it's sustainable. So the FCA sets out 11 principles for business. So this comprise basically the obligations and standards for firms that are conducting any regulated activity. Remember, we looked at the regulated activities before. Now, normally, a breach of the principles specified by the FCA is not enough on its own to bring disciplinary action. However, a previous breach of the principles may be taken into account for the purposes of any future disciplinary action. So the 11 principles are: a firm must conduct itself with integrity, so in terms of having honest dealings with people in the market, and particularly its clients, of course, that it must exercise good skills, care and diligence in terms of the information it's providing, for example, to clients, that it has appropriate management and control procedures in place, particularly risk management in today's world, that it has adequate resources, so it has sufficient finances in place to ensure the sustained continuation of the business, that it is conducting itself within a particular market, so if it's trading in equities or bonds, for example, that it conducts itself in a reasonable way. Very important that customers' interests are placed above those of the firm itself, and particularly importantly, communications with clients must be clear, fair and not misleading. So of course we've seen in recent times a lot of mis-selling cases being brought to courts for regulatory approval in recent times. So avoiding mis-selling by being clear in terms of communications being provided. Managing conflicts of interest, so again ensuring that where there are conflicts of interest that these are clearly reported in writing. Ensuring that any trust that a customer puts in us as an investment firm isn't abused, and that our clients' assets are duly protected by having proper custody arrangements in place for their assets, e.g. securities, equities, etc. that they own, as well as any cash that we're holding on their behalf. Also, the relationship that a firm has with a regulator, they must adopt a cooperative manner with the regulator, the FCA in other words. So in terms of approved persons and control functions, so this is where the regulator is setting down the standards really for particular types of managers and directors within investment firms. So we call these controlled functions. So there are governing functions such as that of the chief executive officer and the directors of the firm. The required functions in terms of oversight, and as we saw just now, money laundering reporting, so you have to nominate a money laundering reporting officer. Systems and control functions, so particularly internal systems management and risk management, and significant management functions. So this is relating to senior management roles and applies to large firms. So these four include all of what are called the significant influence functions. Customer functions, where we're providing advice, dealing, arranging deals, managing investments, have come under a separate type of control. One important assessment criterion is the fit and proper test. So must have a track record of honesty, integrity and reputation. So recently, of course, a fund manager who was found guilty of fair dodging, in fact, has been banned by the FCA because his honesty, integrity and reputation has been brought into question. So in fact has been banned from life from holding a senior position at any firm within the United Kingdom. Competence and capability, so this is evidenced by having appropriate examinations, and financial soundness, so ensuring that the firm can continue in operation, being sufficiently well funded. So there are seven statements of principle for approved persons, so acting with integrity in carrying out controlled functions, so acting in a proper manner, and also acting with the due skill, care and diligence in carrying out that controlled function, so in ensuring that excessive risk isn't taken, for example. Also, ensuring that the expected standards of market conduct, i.e. not market abuse. So the activities of the LIBOR manipulators, the FX fixing players, and also the gold fixing players recently, constitutes market abuse. Dealing with the FCA in an open and cooperative way, as we mentioned just now, ensure that the business itself, the structure of the business, is organised in a sensible way in order that it can be effectively controlled. Also managing the business itself in a careful and diligent way is a requirement. And making sure that the firm conducts its business so that it can comply with the requirements and standards of the regulatory system. Training and competence, so ensuring that people in particular roles have the right level of skills training, that skills are up to date, for example. This can be evidenced by the passing of particular exams. Supervisors have to ensure that they've passed these exams, and employees have to demonstrate that they have an appropriate level of knowledge and skill. So this applies to most of the different activities here that we would normally expect, and as we saw before, the regulated activities. And there's an ongoing maintenance requirement where we confirm basically that employees and supervisors are keeping their knowledge up to date, their technical knowledge, keeping up with the market, that their skills are still relevant, and they're up to date with the market and its regulatory requirements in particular, but also the types of products and any changes to law, of course, that have come into place. So one important development in recent times, further to the RDR, the Retail Distribution Review, this really changed the way that retail product providers related to their clients. So a much higher bar now in terms of what these retail providers need to comply with. So four things here: subscribing to a code of ethics, having an appropriate qualification, carrying out at least 35 hours of continuing professional development, CPD, per annum, and also holding a statement of professional standing from an accredited body is important. So the accredited bodies themselves must inform the financial conduct of authority of any advisors who are not meeting these requirements of a statement of professional standing would demand. Also, we have to declare annually that we're meeting ethical standards in terms of our behaviour towards our clients in particular, and that we have an up-to-date qualification available. So quite a lot of stipulations now within the retail marketing area that weren't there before. Section 4 looks at the regulation of investment exchanges and indeed the clearing houses, the central counterparties that work with them. So the FCA recognises and supervises RIEs, recognised investment exchanges, and recognised clearing houses. These must meet regulatory objectives and obligations and therefore gain exemption from the need for authorisation to carry out regulated activities. So examples of regulated investment exchanges include the London Stock Exchange, the LSE, the London Metal Exchange, the LME, and NYSE Life, so the New York Stock Exchange and the London International Financial Futures Exchange merged together, so they're now known as NYSE Life. So LCH ClearNet is in fact a recognised clearinghouse, and in fact it clears both NYSE Life transactions as well as those on the London Stock Exchange. So the required roles of a recognised investment exchange include delivering high standards of investment protection via their rules and practices, so ensuring that transactions perform, i.e. so when someone buys and sells a security, that transaction doesn't fail within the market. Ensuring that it has enough financial resources so that it can properly conduct the business of an exchange, that it has adequate systems in order to record the transactions that go on within an exchange, that it has appropriate procedures in place for investigating complaints, and that it can effectively monitor and enforce compliance of the members of exchanges that operate within it. Ensuring that its business conducted on exchanges is carried out in an orderly and protective manner, again looking after the interests of investors there. Also ensuring that exchange transactions on securities are only carried out in proper market conditions, that price discovery can evolve through the trading of securities on the exchange, and ensuring that the markets are transparent so that people can be confident that prices are fair and reasonable, which of course gives us a market that has some integrity to it. So the London Stock Exchange itself, of course, a recognised investment exchange, so importantly it has the responsibility for admitting public companies onto the official list, so meeting the UKLA, the UK Listing Authority. That of course is the Financial Conduct Authority itself currently. So the exchange itself admits companies onto the official list, so it maintains the official list once companies have been approved by the FCA in their role as the UK Listing Authority. It also enables trades in UK and international equities, also debts, warrants, etc. Depository receipts, of course, were a means by which we can trade overseas equities on the London Stock Exchange. The Alternative Investment Market, or AIM, is there for companies that don't quite meet the full listing requirements. So you can't, for example, produce 3 years of company accounts. Generally aimed at smaller companies and is subject to lighter regulatory requirements. So the London International Financial Futures and Options Exchange, or LIFE as it's called, owned as I mentioned just now by the New York Stock Exchange Group, is a recognised investment exchange for futures and options. So transactions on this exchange can only be carried out by life members. So like the London Stock Exchange, you have to be a member of the exchange to carry out transactions. So typically there, the members of the firms, brokers and dealers, will have their own clients on whose behalf they put orders onto the systems that comprise Life's operations. So members are either traders, so they're called locals if they act on their own behalf, they have their own balance sheet, buying and selling, or brokers. Brokers, of course, are just executing trades on behalf of their clients. So within the Life London International Financial Futures and Options Exchange, the Market Supervision Department carries out the enforcement of Life rules. In terms of clearing and settlement, so all derivatives exchanges are recognised exchanges that have the power to regulate the market. So all trading is subject to these transparency requirements, but there are no transparency requirements for over-the-counter transactions. So OTC transactions there in derivatives aren't subject to the same stipulations for transparency as exchange-traded instruments. On Life and the London Metal Exchange, once a derivative trade has been matched, it's registered with a central counterparty. Normally, this is LCH ClearNet. And what happens is that where a Life member is trading on behalf of a client, there's a back-to-back contract between the member and the client, making Life members act as principal with respect to the central counterparty and not an agent. So it's a contractual way of managing that relationship. So when we're trading on Life or the London Metal Exchange, there's an initial margin, like a deposit that you have to place with the clearinghouse, London Clearinghouse, to ensure that those participants on the market can cover any losses that they might make in an individual day. So margin deposits for futures contracts are in fact fixed, but with options, because options depend more on volatility, these actually change quite frequently according to market conditions, particularly the volatility within the markets themselves. So all of the open trade positions are revalued daily and then settled to the market, so settled to new market prices. And any profits or losses that have been made on open positions have to be settled with variation margin. So variation margin essentially tops up our initial margin that we put in place at the beginning to further cover exchanges against any potential losses in the future. So a lot of the time actually when we're trading futures, we may well offset one contract with another. So this is a way of cancelling out our contract before it actually reaches its delivery date at a point in the future. So in terms of the regulation of derivatives, so the recognised investment exchanges are self-regulating, where the Financial Conduct Authority ensures that the exchange itself has proper systems in place to enable it to do so. So other multilateral trading facilities also have to comply with transparency rules, but again, over-the-counter transactions are exempted from that transparency rule because of the nature of over-the-counter transactions. These, of course, are where we're trading with another counterparty directly and not via an exchange. So it's a direct bilateral agreement that we have with another counterparty. This contrasts, actually, the UK approach actually contrasts with that in the US, where derivatives trading is quite closely regulated by the Securities and Exchange Commission and indeed the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, the CFTC. So in fact, MiFID introduced commodities futures into the list of regulated investments when it came in. Oil and energy trading firms qualify for an exemption here, but in fact have a separate FCA regulation through a specialist rule book. Now, international accounting standards, IAS 39, so that's international accounting standards, require any derivatives to be measured at fair value. And if there's a profit or loss, it needs to be recognised, or if it's used for hedging, then it's combined effectively with an existing exposure and then is put into the reserves of the company that is using that derivative. Now, EMIR, the European Market Infrastructure Regulation, as we were looking at earlier on, looks at the clearing of over-the-counter derivatives. So where we're trading these over-the-counter derivatives and clearing them via a central counterparty, there are three rules. So those that have been declared have to go through a central counterparty. So risk management procedures need to be in place for those transactions. And there needs to be reporting of these derivative transactions to a trade repository. There's a mandatory clearing obligation to any contracts where the combination of financial counterparties and non-financial counterparties are above clearing thresholds. So where we've got more than €1 billion in gross notional value for equity derivatives and more than €3 billion for any interest rate derivatives such as interest rate swaps, for example, any FX derivatives such as outright forwards and FX swaps, or indeed any commodity instruments such as commodity swaps and that type of thing that are traded over the counter. So €3 billion is the threshold there for mandatory clearing. Section 5 of the syllabus looks at the FCA's business standards and particularly how investment firms relate to their clients. So one important element is the classification of clients. So under the EU's MiFID rules, the Markets in Financial Instruments Directive, which came in November 2007, it has three client categories with different levels of regulatory protection. The greatest level of protection is afforded to retail clients. So these are generally smaller investors who don't fall into the categories of either a professional client or an eligible counterparty, which we'll come on to in a second. But the key point is that the retail clients are those that get the greatest level of protection under the MiFID classifications. To be classified as a professional client, this is where we can categorize. We have to be able to show that our counterparty is knowledgeable, they have the right level of experience, and they don't get quite as much regulatory protection under the MiFID framework. Eligible counterparties include large investment firms, credit institutions, insurance companies, pension firms, really those that are in the business of investment. And these get the lowest level of protection under the MiFID guidelines. So to be categorised as a professional client, you have to be an authorised or regulated entity operating in financial markets and not an eligible counterparty. You have to be a MiFID compliant or equivalent third country business meeting any two of the following criteria. Your balance sheet total is greater than €20 million, a net turnover of €40 million or more, again, and with equity within the business of 2 million euros. So a non-MiFID professional client, so those falling outside of that ambit, is where we've got called up share capital of 5 million pounds, so note the currency there, but then we're back to euros again for the second set of criteria, which is a balance sheet size of 12.5 million, a net turnover of 25 million euros again, and with an average number of employees during the year of 250 or more. So again, note the differences there between MiFID and non-MiFID in terms of being classified as a professional client. So if you're a national or regional government, or indeed you're an institution investor investing in financial instruments, then you can classify as a professional client. But again, the key point is that you're not an eligible counterparty, which we'll come on to in a second. Now, a retail client can elect to be treated as a professional client. So this is up to the retail client to decide whether they want to become a professional client, in which case they may be eligible then to invest in more risky types of products. But even if they do elect, they still can only be classified as a professional client on an elective basis if they meet the following conditions, and all of these conditions need to be met: that they can demonstrate that they've got sufficient experience, expertise and knowledge to understand really the products that are put in front of them. This is called the qualitative test. The second overall test is a quantitative test, and two out of the following three criteria have to be met. So the first is having carried out an average of 10 significant transactions per quarter in the last year. So there's a reasonable volume of trading in financial markets, in other words, going on there. That the financial instruments portfolio exceeds 500,000 euros. So this is cash plus financial instruments. So this is really the investable net worth, is how we would normally talk about this. Investable net worth of the client is greater than that 500,000. And the third criterion, again, two out of these three criteria, the third criterion is that they must have had at least a year's relevant experience in the final sector. And thirdly, the client states in writing that they wish to be treated as a professional client, that the investment firm gives them written warning of the protections that will be lost. So you get greater protection as a retail client. So it's up to the investment firm to say what levels of protection are being lost by electing to become a professional client. And then the client needs to confirm back to the investment firm that they're aware of the protection that they've lost. So eligible counterparties receive the lowest level of protection under the MiFID scheme of things. So this applies to investment firms, all automatically investment firms, credit institutions, insurance companies. So a credit institution, for example, would include banks. Anyone providing collective investment schemes under the UCITS umbrella, and the management companies would all be automatically classified. Pension funds, of course, the largest investors generally by traded volume. And other financial institutions authorised and regulated under European Community legislation. So In this case, MiFID provides for a light touch regulatory regime here. So businesses that are just executing orders, dealing on their own accounts, or receiving and transmitting orders get a light touch regulatory approach, because there's not really too much there that can go wrong with that type of business. So it is not subject to as much regulatory scrutiny as other types of business, like managing pension funds. So you can, again, similar to what we saw before with our professional clients, you can elect to be treated as an eligible counterparty. Again, the client themselves has to elect that they want to lose the added protection of a professional client status. So first of all, you have to start off as a professional client, and you have to make a request that you want to be treated as a eligible counterparty. And the investment firm, again, it's up to the investment firm to get confirmation from their prospective counterparty that they're agreeing to be treated as an eligible counterparty rather than as a professional client. Now, importantly, an investment firm must allow any professional client or eligible counterparty to be recategorized if they choose to do so, to get a higher level of protection. Now, in terms of client agreements with retail clients, firms, investment firms must provide their clients with information about their firm, the investment firm, and the services that it provides, and the terms of the agreement that is being proposed. Now, record keeping, as ever, very important. So here we have the sort of standard 5 years. So under MiFID in particular, there's a 5-year standard. But where we have anything relating to pension decisions, so pension opt-outs, freestanding additional voluntary contributions, pension transfers, anything to do with an investment decision relating to a pension must be kept indefinitely. And if the duration of the relationship with the client is longer than 5 years, then it's however long that relationship goes on. But that's a sort of fairly standard rule there, that we have either 5 years as a default, but for pension decisions, we have this indefinite rule there with regard to any movements of pension fund investments. In terms of communicating with retail clients, so under MiFID, firms must act in the best interests of their clients at all time. So they must comply with these rules on inducements. So any fees or commissions that they receive in terms of the brokerage that they might receive as part of their service, if they're executing a transaction on behalf of their clients and they receive some kind of fee, then that must be used to enhance the quality of the service to the client, over and above what the client could normally expect to receive. So it's not acceptable to reduce your expenses as an investment firm if it relates to something that the client should expect to receive as part of your service. So generally what is allowable as a reasonable non-monetary benefit includes gifts, hospitality, promotional prizes, some sort of promotional assistance, advertising, that type of thing from a product provider, and generic product literature, so assisting with the marketing process. That's sort of a reasonable benefit that an investment firm might be able to accept. So in terms of financial promotions and communications, So under the Financial Services Markets Act of 2000, there's restrictions here on who can do this. So a financial promotion can only be communicated by an authorised person. So they need to be an authorised person by the Financial Conduct Authority. So the communication of the promotion can only be carried out by an authorised person, and the content itself must have been approved similarly by an authorised person. Now, in terms of what goes into the promotion, it must be made clear where the client's capital is at risk. There must be a balanced impression in terms of the short and long-term prospects for products, including any quoted yields, i.e. the returns that we're saying that our clients could receive from the investment. It needs to be very clear what the fees and charging structure for the product is, i.e. as an investment firm, how much do we take from the provision of this product. The Financial Conduct Authority must be named in the literature as the regulator. So it would say that a particular investment firm is regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority, for example. Also, fair and clear information about the source of the product. So who is actually the underlying investment manager, for example, if we're just acting as a promoting agent, for example. So these rules don't apply to non-cold calling to retail clients. So these rules don't apply where the retail client is already expecting the call. In other words, where there's already an existing relationship with the client. So an absolutely critical rule, particularly in the light of the recent mis-selling scandals across the industry, is that any promotion must be fair, clear, and not misleading. So any communication or financial promotion must meet these stipulations. The only exceptions are where we've got, for example, a one-off promotion that's not a cold call, and where financial promotions are only communicated to investment professionals. These are our professional clients or eligible counterparties who are deemed to have more expert knowledge, so they can kind of make their own minds up about the product. But when communicating to retail products, the rules are pretty clear in terms of the clarity of what is being presented to them. So when communicating with retail clients, we've got to ensure that we include the name of the firm in any information, that we get a good balanced view of the potential benefits, but also highlighting the risks that our investor is going to incur. Also, that the information is detailed in a clear and understandable way that would be understandable to an average client. And also that there is no disguising or dilution or obscuration of any of the important terms, statements or warnings within the promotion. So it needs to be clear what's going on here, and any drawbacks with the product being illiquid, for example, or having a significant chance of loss need to be very clearly stated. So tax treatments, importantly, we need to say explicitly that the tax treatments, any tax benefits that we might get from this product, are dependent on the circumstances of each client, of course. Every client will have their own separate taxation status. And also when comparisons are made, so for example, if we're comparing our product's performance to an index or to the peer group for this particular product type, that these comparisons are fair, that the benchmark, for example, that's being used is a sensible one, and that it's a reasonable comparison that's being made. So particularly when past performance is being indicated. So very often, of course, investment firms will show their track record in terms of the performance of a fund product or other type of offering, and usually there'll be some kind of index to which the product is being compared. So the investment firm would say that we outperform the index by 10% over the last 5 years, for example. But there are very important rules here in terms of communicating this information to our retail clients. Firstly, that this indication is not the most prominent feature of the communication. Now, this is because, of course, we're talking about past information here. If we know anything about financial markets, we know that the 5 years, for example, in front of us may well not be the same as the last 5 years that we've experienced. So where we've got performance information being presented which covers the immediately preceding 5 years, or the whole period related to the information if less than 5 years. So if we've only got 3 years of data, we can't choose just 2 years of it. We have to show the whole track record. The whole point about this is to avoid companies cherry picking their data. So the performance information must show full 12-month periods. The reference period and the source of information must be clearly stated. So who's calculated the performance data, for example? Where did the index come from? We need to clearly say that past performance is not a reliable indicator of future results. That needs to be clearly stated. Also importantly, we need to state that if the figures are based on a currency other than that of a European Economic Area state, then the currency needs to be clearly stated as well. And we need to again give an explicit warning regarding exchange rate fluctuation. Also, if we're displaying gross performance, in other words, we're reporting figures that are gross of fees, i.e. before fees have been deducted, then the effects of any fees, commissions, any other charges that are going to be deducted from the client's return need to be clearly stated. Now, while we've got cold calls and any verbal promotion, we're defining a cold call as an unsolicited visit, telephone conversation, or any other interactive communication such as email or such like, and where the purpose is to promote a financial product. Now, very clear rules here about when financial firms can do this. So specifically, it's where a client relationship already exists and where the client is expecting a call. So they would expect a call from their advisor every so often to promote new things. If it's a low volatility, a lower risk marketable type of product, then we can make a cold call based on that, irrespective of whether we have a relationship in place. But in any case, it must be relating to regulated investment business, and always regulated investments in readily realizable securities, i.e. liquid investments, and marketable, non-geared, non-leveraged, in other words, packaged products. Any non-written financial promotions, particularly telephone calls, must be an appropriate time of the day, i.e. you can't call your client up at 1 o'clock in the morning. At the beginning of the call, the firm's name must be given and the purpose of the call should be stated. The product that is being promoted needs to be stated at the beginning. The client must be given an option to end the call whenever they want to, and contact details of yourself and your firm also need to be provided. The firm itself, the investment firm, must have adequate systems and controls in place to ensure compliance with these rules. Now again, in terms of record keeping, the same type of rules apply here. The pension transaction activities, so anything where we're promoting something to do with transferring a pension entitlement or an opt-out or a freestanding additional voluntary contribution. Even though it's only a promotion, records must be kept indefinitely. Similarly, our MiFID type of business, again, that's the 5-year rule stipulated as a standard by MiFID. Now, an exception here is where we're talking about just promoting a life policy or a pension fund. So the difference here with the pension fund element is that we're not talking about changing an existing arrangement. We're talking about a new product. In this case, we need to keep records for 6 years after the communication occurs. As with most cases, any other type of business outside of MiFID, we need to keep records for 3 years. In terms of distance marketing communication, so firms must provide their customers with all of this information in good time before a consumer might be bound by a distance contract or offer that's being made. These need to include, very similar to before in fact, information about the firm, clear information about the financial service, clear information about the contract, so the specific terms and conditions of the product that's being promoted, information about redress, so what happens if we have a complaint as a customer, and again, as before, all information must be presented in a clear and comprehensible manner. So for the average retail investor, is it understandable what is being promoted to them? So in terms of the information about the firm and any compensation that's being paid, so general information relating to the retail clients, as a standard, the contact details of the firm. We need to have a record of the languages in which the client will be communicated. What methods of communication acceptable? Is it acceptable to send emails, texts, etc.? All of that needs to be specified. There needs to be a statement to the effect that the firm is authorised, and the name and contact address of the authorising agency, usually the Financial Conduct Authority, of course, needs to be clearly stated. So the FCA, of course, in the United Kingdom, so that clients, if they have an issue, they know who to contact to make a complaint. Also, if you are acting as an agent, we say who we're acting as an agent for. Also, we need to say any performance reports, how those are going to be reported. So they're going to come in paper formats, by email, for example, how often we're going to get them, and how frequently we're going to report the data. Also, there needs to be a clear statement of how firms themselves manage their conflicts of interest. Information relating specifically to investment management services, so this is where an investment firm is managing a portfolio of assets on behalf of their clients. So separate stipulations here are that we need to have a clear statement on how the valuation of the investments in the portfolio is going to be carried out. So how are they going to be valued? Are they going to be using market prices? Is it going to be an independent valuation agent, for example? And how often are we going to provide that information? Needs to be clearly stated. Any delegation of part of the portfolio management process needs to be stated. So if we've outsourced the real estate investment management part of the portfolio, we need to clearly state who is providing that service. We need to specify the benchmark, the index against which we're going to be reporting the performance of our portfolio. We need to set out the universe of investments that could be included in the portfolio and what types of transactions might be carried out. For example, if there are any derivative transactions that were going to be used, and any limits that we might have with regard to those. Also setting out the management objectives. So, for example, what sort of return targets might we be looking for? What sort of risk might we be taking as measured by standard deviation, or in the world of bonds, how much duration or interest rate risk are we going to take? And how much of the risk is in the hands of the manager? So how much discretion do they have over the allocations within the portfolio? Again, all of that needs to be very clearly stated. Now, since the retail distribution review, or RDR as it's generally called, since the 1st of January 2013, it's no longer possible for firms making personal recommendations to retail clients, again retail clients here with the highest level of protection, to earn commission paid by a product provider. So the objective of this really was to ensure that retail clients got independent advice rather than being sold products on commission, more looking to provide them with better financial advice, really. So for this advisory service, firms now get paid an advisor charge, which needs to be agreed with the client in advance. So this is, as I'm saying, the independent or restricted advice that we might provide. So independent advice is where we can choose from a very broad range of potential products. Restricted advice is where we're only choosing from a small number. We have to, as we'll see in a second, there are special rules surrounding that. Now, this does not apply to basic advice, so stakeholder products with pre-scripted questions, for example, or where it's execution only. So if our client is just telling us to buy Marks and Spencer shares, then we don't have to subscribe to this these regulations. So under these rules, a firm may not solicit or indeed accept any commission, remuneration or other benefits, irrespective of whether we intend to pass it on to the client. So we just cannot receive any kind of commission at all. And product providers are not allowed to pay it either, so the regulations cover both product providers and investment advisory firms as well. The firm's charging structure, i.e. the advisor charges that they're looking to charge the clients, need to be disclosed to the client in writing in good time before advice is provided. If the actual charge is going to be materially different from that, then that must be disclosed to the client as soon as possible. So the total advisor charge that will be payable to the firm by the retail client must be agreed with the client and clearly communicated via a website. Firms are also again required to keep records of the charging structure, the total advisor charge, and any differences. So if they're charging a client more for a special piece of advice, then the reasons for the different, the value-added services provided, need to be very clearly specified. This also applies to any product providers that are directly going to retail clients. So they're also subject to these rules, and they're specifically there. They must be very clear about the differences between the product costs, for example, the management charges, and any advisory charges. They can't bundle the two together. They have to be very clear about what is being charged for which service. Now, the Financial Conduct Authority has the power to intervene in any products that it feels may not be in the interests of the investment community at large, So particularly they would intervene here where they felt that the product was in serious danger of being missold. For example, if it would be unlikely that a retail client could understand a particular product, perhaps one that relies on derivatives or structured products. So here the FCA can use their temporary product intervention rules, TPIR, in order to prevent the product being sold for in fact a period of no longer than 12 months. So quite an important tool there that the FCA has to prevent mis-selling while it investigates, and it may well in fact insist that the product is either changed or not sold at all. One very important element of selling products to clients is that it must be suitable for the client, not too risky, for in other words, for example, an older type of investor. So firms have to assess the products that they're selling with regard to their retail clients, their professional clients, and any eligible counterparties before they render their advisory or discretionary services. So they've got to find out what might be suitable types of products for their clients, in other words. So they would need to gather information such as the client's investment objectives, what their financial situation is. So for example, if they have a lot of cash in the bank, maybe they can afford to buy less liquid securities. Also, they need to assess their level of knowledge or experience, particularly if they're going to be categorized as professional clients or eligible counterparties. Now, with our professional clients and eligible counterparties, we assume that they have the knowledge to understand the risks in relationship to their investment. So firms must provide a suitability report to a retail client if there's a personal recommendation being made into any kind of products here, a collective investment scheme, investment trust, pension products, etc. So it's got to describe in the suitability report why and how this product is suitable for a particular retail client's circumstances. Churning and switching, this is basically where we're overtrading. So as a firm overtrading, of course, to generate higher commissions for ourselves. So excessive buying and selling of securities not in the best interest of the clients is strictly forbidden. So the frequency of transactions should be determined based on the client's investment profile. So in terms of appropriateness, so for example here we're talking about services provided such as execution only, so we need to determine whether the service being provided is suitable or not. If we felt that a product that a client is requesting is inappropriate, then we have to issue a warning. Even if the client themselves are saying that they want something, we have to issue a warning that in our view it's not appropriate for this particular client. So this appropriateness test is not required when we're dealing in non-complex investments. How do we define these? Well, first of all, that it's not a derivative, that it's easily traded. For example, it's listed on the London Stock Exchange, for example, that information on its value is easily available, again, where a listed equity, for example, is being traded in, then that would be non-complex. We can easily see what the price is from the price in the market. Where the obligation itself doesn't exceed the cost of holding the instruments, so again, this is down to derivatives and leveraged investments generally. So if we've got our equity, the most we can lose is what we've invested, not more than that, for example, that you would get with, for example, contracts for differences and other derivative-based securities. And also the information on the nature of the investment is publicly available. So it's kind of a publicly available information set that is there. Now, investment firms are allowed to provide both independent, so fully independent, investment advice against a broad range of retail investment products. It can also provide restrictive advice where it's only selecting from a limited number of providers, but it must disclose in writing and orally before they provide any advice that they only provide advice on this restricted set of providers, and explain why that is to the satisfaction of the regulator. So it can provide restricted advice, but it needs to be able to explain why that is in the interest of the client, for example. Otherwise, it's independent advice that it should be providing against a broad range of products. I.e., again, the point here is really that the Financial Conduct Authority doesn't want advisors to retail clients in particular selling them products. They want them to provide advice to help with their investment portfolios. So we're obliged to execute on the best execution policy rules here. So we need to ensure that we are getting the best price, for example, for a particular security, either buying or selling. So we need to be clear here about how we're going about this. So it matters whether we're what type of client we are, whether retail, professional client, or an eligible counterparty. What the characteristics of the execution venues are. So again, normally we would expect execution of stocks to go through a stock exchange, for example. So firms are obliged to annually review their order execution policy. So the key point there is that we're certifying that we're always acting in the best interests of the clients when executing transactions on their behalf. In terms of client order handling, so firms need to ensure that orders are executed properly and accurately, and also recorded and allocated quickly as well. So again, the record keeping element is pretty critical here. Also, carrying out comparable client orders at the same time, unless there's some good reason for this. So again, we're not favouring one client rather than another. That's very important. And it must also, the investment firm must inform a retail client if it's having material difficulty in carrying out a particular trade. And it must do so as soon as the firm becomes aware that there's an issue with transacting out their particular order there. So the use of dealing commission, or soft dollars as they're sometimes called, as we mentioned earlier on, must be used to the benefit of the client, the marginal benefits of the client indeed. So we can't use our commission that we are earning on any transaction. So if we get a brokerage commission, we can't use it to reduce the costs of what we should already be providing to the client, nor indeed, of course, for anything that's to our benefit. So it must be an additional benefit to the client. So for example, you would expect an investment firm to have sufficient computer hardware and networking facilities in place. So we can't use commissions to reduce that overhead. So important point that anything that we would normally expect the investment firm to provide, we cannot use dealing commissions or soft dollars to reduce those costs. It has to be an additional service that we're providing to the client over and above what we would normally expect to see. So there's a list here basically of the things that one might imagine, but that's the overriding rule, really, that these things, all of these areas are services that we would expect to receive as a client of the firm. So we can't use the commission to reduce the cost of them. So the FCA provides some very restrictive regulations on personal account dealing. So you have to be very careful where there are activities that might result in a conflict of interest, particularly importantly where there's insider information. So we, either by accident or by deliberate policy, we've got some information that is material, non-public information, i.e. that would impact the price were it to become public knowledge. Also, any confidential information relating to the client or their transactions. So we can't act on any of these sources of information and put trades on that would be to our benefit, of course. So the firm must be informed properly, so anyone within the firm must report to the compliance officer any personal transactions at all that have been carried out, and the firm itself must keep a record of these transactions, and also any transactions that were not allowed and the reasons why they weren't allowed also need to be kept on record as well. Now, investment research is obviously very often provided as part of the service to our clients. So the key point here is that where we're providing independent research and information, we have to label it as such, as an independent, objective explanation of matters at hand, so economic analysis, for example, or market analysis, currency analysis, etc. But we have to label it as objective and independent explanations of what's going on, i.e. research that we've produced. Also, what would count towards this is any proposition of an investment strategy or a recommendation that's based on a forecasted present or future value or of one or more financial instruments or issuers of those instruments. So anything that is not classified as investment research in fulfilling these criteria here must be classified as a marketing communication, a sales communication, in other words. So importantly, when investment firms are producing investment research, there must be suitable firewalls to ensure that the research that's being carried out is independent, i.e. it's not going to support a particular product that the client is promoting. Very much there must be no front running. So this is where we might be publishing an article which suggests that a particular security or a particular sector may do well in the future. Well, we can't buy shares on our own account ahead of that publication because it could move the markets, of course, in that regard. So analysts involved in producing this research must not accept gifts or any other consideration that could compromise their independence and objectivity. So if you remember, the independence and objectivity was part of the CFA's guidelines here. So there's a synergy here with those CFA standards that we saw earlier on. So remuneration that's received by the researchers should not be linked to a specific transaction, nor to any recommendations contained in the research. Again, to preserve this independence and objectivity. So again, the suitable Chinese walls or firewalls need to be in place to ensure that there's no coercion by sales staff to promote a particular type of product. And financial analysts should not be used in a marketing capacity if that would jeopardise their independence. So where firms are producing a research recommendation, they must very clearly disclose the person who wrote the recommendation, including their name and job title. The name of the firm needs to be specified, and also the identity of the competent authority if the firm is an investment firm or a credit institution. So who is the regulated entity, in other words? So if the research is non-written, there must be a place where the disclosures can easily be accessed, so a website would be an easy way of doing that. So firms are under an obligation to ensure that where they're providing these recommendations, they clearly distinguish facts from opinions, that any sources of data are clearly labelled, any projections, forecasts and price targets are labelled, and where we're making assumptions, for example about interest rate levels, inflation, etc., that these assumptions are clearly disclosed. And the substance of the recommendation must be reasonable. So there must be a reasonable chance that a forecast could be correct at some point in the future. And records must be retained as ever for the FCA's purposes. Relating to packaged products, so what is a packaged product? We talk about life policies there. That, of course, is a package of life insurance and an investment product. Any units in a regulated collective investment scheme, an interest in an investment trust saving scheme, any stakeholder pension plan or a personal pension plan. These are all examples of packaged products. So any independent advisory firm providing advice on these must clarify their scope with regard to the whole of the market or sector. So is it providing advice across a whole series of products, or is it restricted to a small number, or indeed just one? Now again, it must keep records regarding the scope of its activities for at least 5 years. So where a firm is providing a key features document, which is obligatory when it's making a recommendation to a private customer, so here importantly it must be produced to the same quality as any other marketing material. It must display the firm's logo or brand at least as prominently as any other, so it must be clear who is promoting this. It must also have the key facts logo prominently displayed at the top of the document, and also it must clearly say who the regulator is, etc., and what the redress is. So the document also needs to say, make a statement about the complexity of the products, the limitations, how it works, the benefits and risks, what the complaints procedure is if something goes wrong, etc. So very important rules there. Now, clients have a right to cancel any decision they've made. So this is designed to, of course, reduce pressurized selling techniques. So for any life policies and pension plans, long-term types of investments, including personal and stakeholders, you have 30 days in which you can cancel the product that you've bought. Any other packaged product, like an investment trust, as we saw just now, that would be only up to 14 days that you would have to cancel. Now, where there has been a cancellation, again, we've got to retain records. If it relates to a change in existing pension arrangement, a pension transfer, opt-out, or freestanding additional voluntary contribution, the rule is we need to keep it indefinitely. As with all of the MiFID rules, generally, at least 5 years for life policies, pension contracts, etc., so this is a new product rather than an existing one that we were talking about in the first instance, and then any other business, it's at least 3 years is the obligation. So the FCA has recently introduced a new category of retail investment products to contrast with packaged products. So some of the packaged products are now classified as retail investment products. These include any life policies, units in collective investment schemes, stakeholder and personal pensions, any interest in investment trust, any security in an investment trust, any structured capital at risk products, so any product with a derivative package within it, and any other designated investment offering exposure to underlying financial assets. So exchange traded funds would be a good example of this. So importantly, any independent investment advisor must have good knowledge of all of these types of products, rather than just a narrow range of packaged products. So the point about this, of course, is that the people providing advice to their investors can provide better advice and more choice to provide a better, more tailored, suitable package of products for their clients. Now, we've looked at rules for record keeping already, but the FCA sets out requirements. So any MiFID or equivalent third country business, and for any life and pension contracts, so new life and pension contract business, we must keep the records for 5 years. Anything relating to an existing pension type of product, any transfer, any opt-out, or any freestanding additional voluntary contribution, these must be kept indefinitely. So any discussion that we have relating to changing someone's existing pension, we must keep records on that indefinitely. Any other business, we must have at least 5 years. Suitability records we need to keep. Again, the MiFID rule is a 5-year blanket rule, and for any other business, 3 years, and as ever, pension transfers, opt-outs, etc., must be kept forever. So in terms of the reporting requirements to clients, occasional reporting that we're providing, so for example, execution of client orders, it needs to have all of the essential information relating to the execution of the order, so the price, quantity, the time it was executed, the settlement dates, that type of stuff. On the client's request, they must be provided with the information relating to their orders. And again, as ever with MiFID, it's a 5-year record keeping period. Anything else that's non-MiFID is a 3-year period. Both periods apply from the point of dispatch, so when the order was actually placed. So in terms of periodic reporting, so occasional reporting of course applies when we're executing a particular transaction. Periodic reporting is a sort of a periodic statement. So we've got to provide these at least every 6 months or every 3 months if the client requests it. So if the client only wants to see records on a transactional basis, this needs to be provided at least once a year. Anywhere that we've got a leveraged portfolio, this must be provided once a month. Leveraged portfolios, of course, by their very nature, are more risky and therefore, of course, can change by a great deal more. So there's an additional reporting requirement for leveraged portfolios because of their additional risk and potentially their higher volatility. In terms of reporting information about authorised funds to unit holders, so the fund manager in this regard must provide a short report and a long report, half yearly and annually, a bit like firms, for example, producing their interim and annual reports, very similar here for authorised fund holders. So the obligation is to send the short report to all unit holders and to make the long report available to the unit holders on request. So this can be done via a website, would be an easy way to do that. So the short report needs to have the name of the scheme, a clear statement of the investment objectives, the name and address of the authorised fund manager, a brief statement of its risk profile, some record of performance, anything else that the fund manager deems relevant there, so any environmental impact, anything else that may be of interest to our investor, and it also needs to say that the latest long report is available on request, perhaps via the firm's website. Now, with regard to client assets and money, the investment firm has a fiduciary duty. This is an obligation to act in the best interests of another party. So where we've got responsibility for clients' assets and or money, we must exercise all of the skill, care and diligence at our disposal. So in other words, we've got to treat the client's asset and money as if it was our own. So this applies where particularly we've got custody of client assets. We've got to ensure that there's adequate protection here, so that they're properly registered in terms of the legal title or appropriate nominee company that we use. But it needs to be clear that the securities and or the cash that we're holding on behalf of the client can be attributed to that client. In terms of using client assets, so particularly with regard to stock lending or repurchase agreements, the client must clearly state that they're happy for the securities to be used, and it must specify the terms and restrictions on the use of those assets. So where an investment firm is depositing client assets with a third party, a custodian for example would be a normal state of affair here, the investment firm needs to make sure that the third party is properly reviewed and that they are fit and proper really to hold and keep the assets of the firm safe. So that needs to be periodically reviewed, and again records need to be kept that that's being carried out. Very importantly, the client's financial assets, securities, cash, etc. must be clearly separated from the assets of the firm and of any designated third party. So segregated in a separate client account or a separate nominee account. So very important this, that the market reputation and expertise of the third party looking after the assets of the firm needs to be carefully checked out, due diligence carried out on the client. And we need to also be clear about how the client's rights are affected by the requirement to hold financial instruments. As ever, records need to be kept of the policies and where things are being kept. So again, 5 years after the firm, after the investment firm ceases to use the services of a custodian for client assets, it needs to keep records of their dealings with them. So there's an obligation that we reconcile the client's assets, so we will have records of what we think the client should have. These need to be reconciled with the custodian's record of what they are holding on behalf of the client. So we need to do two levels of reconciliation. We need to reconcile what the client thinks they have against what we have as an investment firm and against any third parties, and we need to do a reconciliation of the investment firm's accounts against the custodian or other third party. So these need to be done, so external recommendations need to be done as often as necessary. So this can be done generally by the total count method. So all of the financial instruments are counted and reconciled as at the same date. Anything else other than the total count method needs to be confirmed and verified by the firm's auditors, so by the investment firm's audited auditors need to confirm to the Financial Conduct Authority that the systems and controls in place are adequate and sufficient as they would have been using the total account method. Any discrepancies that we find need to be corrected, and the difference needs to be made good. So if we find that the client has a shortfall of £1,000, then we need to make good the difference as soon as we find that there is a difference in the records. Now, specifically with client money rules, here of course, rather than looking at a securities custodian, we're specifically looking at a client bank account, of course. So a client bank account can be opened with any of the following: a central bank, although that's probably unlikely, a qualifying money market fund, so this is a fund that invests in very safe treasury type securities like treasury bills, etc. Any bank that's authorised in a third country, or indeed in our own country of course, or any credit institution that is approved. So the form of the bank account needs to be either a general client bank account, so a normal bank account in the name of the client. The key point is in fact that the accounts are identified separately from any accounts used to hold money by the firm or indeed any third party. So there needs to be clearly designated accounts here in which we can identify the client's money. Accurate records, as ever, the 5-year rule there. So we need to keep records for 5 years after a particular bank account has ceased being used for this purpose. So as before, we need to reconcile client money in the same way that we were reconciling client assets, the client security portfolios in other ways. Exactly the same as before, really. We've got our internal reconciliation between what the client feels it has and the client's actual bank account statements, and then also an external reconciliation is what we have as an investment firm against the third party, in this case a bank account's statement. So we need to do both reconciliations as often is necessary after the date to which a reconciliation should be carried out. Similar to before, any shortfall needs to be immediately made good. Now, mandated accounts is where we've got the ability, so we've been given discretion. Over the management of a firm's, of a client's affairs. So we've been given the ability to control a client's assets or liabilities for that matter. So this is where we've got written consent being provided by the client. We've also got to retain those records as ever, of course. So it's where we've got ability to make decisions really, and give instructions on behalf of the client relating to their money, relating to money for which that person is responsible but may refer to the client's entitlement, to other people that are responsible, or indeed where their client may incur a liability for that person. So importantly there, the circumstances are that the client does not need to be involved in the decision process. So we can make the decision, that's the discretionary element of a mandated account. Section 6 looks at the Financial Conduct Authority's arrangements for supervision and redress, so what rights do investors have in the event that there's been a breach of FCA regulations. So the powers of the FCA really fall into the four categories we have here. So banking insurance groups fall into category one. These are banking insurance groups that have a large number of retail investors and or the universal investment banks that have very large clients' assets and or trading operations. So if they're trading in equities, foreign exchange, bonds, derivatives, etc. Category 2 is firms across all sectors that have a substantial number of retail investors and or that are large wholesale firms, i.e. so that's different sectors. Of course, they're not necessarily banks. Category 3 is really firms across all sectors where there's either retail customers or a significant wholesale presence. And then finally, of course, we have Category 4, smaller firms, including almost all of the intermediaries. So these are the intermediaries we're looking at in the previous section, of course, providing advice to retail clients. So those smaller advisors fall into Category 4. If you do, then you only get assessed by the Financial Conduct Authority every 4 years. So the supervision model of the Financial Conduct Authority is based on 3 pillars. So first is the firm systematic framework. So this is to see whether the structure of the firm is adequate to meet the needs of regulation. There's event-driven work, so if there's a complaint by a client, for example, or some market failure, then the FCA will get involved there. And thirdly, to do with issues and products. So again, we saw just now that the Financial Conduct Authority has powers to suspend products on a temporary basis if they feel that they may be in danger of being missold or in some other way that retail investors would be disadvantaged. The overall purpose of the firm systematic framework is really to ensure that the interests of customers are put first and that market integrity is maintained. So people are confident, in other words, in the system and therefore will place their savings into investments for the development of the economy. So this is all very central to the work of the FCA. So the disciplinary powers that the FCA has fall into these categories. So it has the power to gather information. So it can ask firms to produce the information that it requests. It can request them to write reports. It can conduct investigations. And it can gain access to premises with a warrant to carry out investigations and to gather information. So in the case of a breach, the FCA can issue a private warning, it can choose to make a public statement, and it can also choose to impose a fine as well. Now in terms of permissioning, so in the beginning firms have to apply for permission to conduct investment business within the United Kingdom, and the FCA has the power to cancel that permission if the firm or an individual for that matter has breached its obligations under the FCA's regulation. Any FCA decisions can be appealed at the Tax and Chancery Chamber of the Upper Tribunal, and that's an independent body separate to the Financial Conduct Authority. So there is a separate appeals procedure for firms that want to appeal their decisions. So with regard to client complaints, there's a two-stage system. So first of all, a firm should carry out its own internal investigation and come up with some restitution or other approach for the client. If the client is still not satisfied once the firm has done everything that the firm is prepared to do, then it will be referred after that to the Financial Ombudsman Service, who will conduct an external investigation. So requirements for firms, they must have implemented effective procedures for handling complaints. All staff within the organisation must be aware of what they are, and it must be published. Records, as ever, must be kept 5 years for MiFID business, 3 years for anything else. And it also, on top of that, must provide the FCA of a twice yearly report, how many complaints have been made, how many have been completed within 4, 8 and more than 8 weeks of receipt, and how many of the complaints have been accepted by the firm as valid. Once it's received a complaint, it has 8 weeks to have sent either a final response or a written response explaining why a final response can't be provided. Informs the complainant of the right to refer the matter to the Financial Ombudsman Service, and you have to enclose a copy of the Financial Ombudsman Service's standards with your explanation. So the Financial Ombudsman Service themselves has two jurisdictions. So the compulsory jurisdiction covers all firms regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority for certain types of complaints. There's also voluntary jurisdiction. So this is where firms have voluntarily signed up to the Financial Ombudsman Service. This, of course, may give their clients more comfort that they will be dealt with fairly in the event of a dispute. Now, importantly, any complaint must be referred to the Financial Ombudsman Service a maximum of 3 years, or 3 years from the customer having had knowledge of the problem. So the Financial Ombudsman Service can dismiss a complaint if there's been no financial loss, for example, no material inconvenience or material distress. It can decide that the complaint is either vexatious or frivolous. And it can also decide that the firm has actually already made a reasonable offer of compensation. So the first port of call, really, for the Ombudsman is to try to mediate a settlement that's acceptable to both the investment firm and their clients. If unsuccessful, the Financial Ombudsman will carry out an investigation and will then make a written statement of determination of what its decision is. The maximum amount that can be awarded is £150,000, so that's the maximum that can be enforced. The Ombudsman can recommend an amount greater than that, but cannot actually compel the firm to pay an amount above the £150,000 that's stipulated by law. In addition to this, there's the Financial Services Compensation Scheme. So this is an independent body, actually, set up under the Financial Services Markets Act of 2000. So this really relates to firms that were authorised by the FCA that have become insolvent or are no longer trading. So any firms that are still trading and are solvent are handled by the Ombudsman, as we saw just now. So really the Financial Services Compensation Scheme is really there to protect investors, but as before, all claims must be made within 6 years of an incident, and the maximum payout under this scheme is in fact £50,000 in fact. Section 7 looks at financial crime, and particularly here, insider dealing, money laundering, extremely important that firms have the adequate processes and procedure in place to prevent money laundering from happening. So in fact, what money laundering is the practice of disguising the proceeds of crime. So essentially, it's the legitimization of funds from drug or other criminally related acts. So the legislation is in fact the Proceeds of Crime Act of 2002 is the most recent legislation here. Anything relating to terrorist financing was actually set out in the Terrorism Act of 2000. So importantly, there's three stages of money laundering. Firstly, there's placement, where the cash is injected into the financial system in the first place, how it finds its way into a bank account originally. The second stage is layering, where usually a number of transactions through different counterparties, different bank accounts are used to disguise the origin and the source of the money. And then the final stage is integration, so where the funds are made to look legitimate when they reach the final bank account or other destination. So importantly, as well as participating in any of these stages of money laundering, it's a criminal offence, in fact, to not be suspicious of any behaviour that would ordinarily arouse suspicion. So if you see something that you think you're suspicious of, that is outside of the norm, then you are actually committing offence by not reporting it. So the only defence here, in fact, is if your employer hasn't actually provided you with the necessary training. So money laundering training, as you can imagine, is de rigueur for most financial firms, in fact. So within the European Union, the third EU money laundering directive came into operation in the United Kingdom in December of 2007. So there are four key questions that it imposes on firms. So first of all, what are the firm's anti-money laundering and terrorist financing risks? So these relate to the jurisdiction in which a firm does business. It relates to the products or services, so what sorts of clients. So if you, for example, you're advising high net worth clients from Russia, for example, then you might say that that's a risk of money laundering. And also the types of customers that you serve, as I say, with the high net worth individuals. What steps could be taken to reduce those risks? Again, how could procedures be put in place to carry out? So, for example, know your client or KYC rules are in place so that, for example, one can track back to find the origin of the source of funds would be one step to avoid those risks. What policies could be put in place to mitigate the risks that have been identified? And what procedures are appropriate for the type of business that you're engaged in and for the types of customers that you're serving. So firms have an obligation under the customer due diligence to properly verify the identity of their customers. So how do we verify that people are who they say they are? And also, how can we identify those agents or other people closely linked to them where we feel that's appropriate? So we need to have more than one, generally, source of identity. So this is why we generally have to provide not only our passport, but also a recent utility bill which has an address on it. We have to be able to identify the beneficial owner, so not just perhaps the person that we're dealing with, but who is actually the beneficial owner of the funds. And also we need to understand the purpose and intended nature of any business relationship. So investment firms have an obligation to keep documents and records up to date regarding the customer due diligence and conduct ongoing monitoring of the business relationship. So it's not good enough to just have a one-off type of approach. It needs to be an ongoing process to ensure that there is compliance here. So in terms of the levels of due diligence that are required, the simplified due diligence really applies to the credit or financial institutions subject to the third money laundering directive. So any supervised credit or financial institutions, so banks, fund management companies, for example, have the simplified due diligence process. Any listed companies, any beneficiaries of solicitors' accounts, solicitors have their own requirements, in fact, already. So from the point of view of the regulators of financial markets, they assume that the solicitors' regulators have already insisted on certain know-your-client types of regulations, and also certain types of public authorities, transactions relating to insurance products, pension schemes, etc. It's unlikely, given the timescale relating to pension schemes and life insurance products, that people will use them to launder money through. So in that case, the simplified due diligence rules suffice. So enhanced due diligence, so the stricter rules relating to due diligence, are where business is conducted not on a face-to-face basis, so where bankers, for example, haven't actually met their clients, particularly, for example, with correspondent banking relationships. So we've got a bank in the former Soviet Union, for example, that is corresponding with our bank, so we can't actually know who the end source of clients is. Any situation where there's a higher risk of money laundering or terrorist financing, and importantly, where the customer is a politically exposed person. So a politically exposed person is someone who is performing a prominent role in public life in either the UK or indeed in any other country. So here, of course, the issue is to do with potential bribery and processing the proceeds of bribery is the key risk here, of course. So the Financial Conduct Authority demands that each firm has a money laundering reporting officer, so a point man basically, who provides the necessary reporting, etc. And the requirement is that investment firms maintain specific policies, procedures, etc., and training programs, importantly, for all staff to prevent their businesses being used for money laundering purposes. And the two goals of this really are to enable suspicious characters to be recognized and reported to the authorities, and to ensure that if a particular customer comes under investigation, there's a trail, an audit trail, if you like, of what's happened with that particular client. So there are no detailed rules on money laundering. Again, it's really up to the individual firm, depending on the type of business they have, depending on what types of clients they're dealing with, to determine really what might constitute suspicious behaviour. So it's all established really in the high level principles in that SYSC systems and controls requirements that you have under the FCA guidelines. The Financial Services, the Financial Conduct Authority itself refers to the Joint Money Laundering Steering Group for its own guidance on this. So this government department sets out the requirements really for the types of internal procedures, controls and policies to prevent money laundering. So it's the job of the money laundering reporting officer to liaise with outside parties, so for example the police force, for example, in terms of any investigations. It should have proper internal procedures to properly identify clients. Again, that requirement for record retention, similarly here it's a 5-year requirement. There needs to be capacity within the firm to recognise and report any suspicious transactions via the money laundering reporting officer to the authorities, the serious organised crime authority there, and it must have effective training procedures in place to make sure that staff are aware of what needs to happen and are able to channel information through the right way. So there are four offences under money laundering. There's assistance to any person or involvement directly in money laundering, so that's punishable with a fine and or a prison sentence up to 14 years. Tipping off anyone that's under investigation, so normally under investigation the transactions are allowed to go through, so the police authorities can trace transactions back. So tipping off anyone who's under investigation can carry a fine and a jail sentence of up to 2 years. Failing to report any knowledge or suspicion of money laundering, a fine and up to a 5-year jail sentence. And then failure to comply with the requirements of the regulations, again a fine and up to 2 years imprisonment. The other main form of financial crime is to do with insider dealing. So this is where we have an advantage, essentially, over the rest of the market, particularly talking here, of course, about public markets, public equities, for example, where we've got more information or better information than other people trading in the market and therefore have got an unfair advantage. So under the Criminal Justice Act of 1993, insider information is specific and precise, price-sensitive information that could have a significant effect on the price of a security if it were to be made public. That's the key points there. So there are three principal offences here. So dealing while in possession of insider information, so if you actually are party to information that the rest of the market doesn't have, then that's an offence to actually deal based on that. Encouraging someone else to deal, a spouse for example, is also an offence. And also disclosing information outside of the course of one's normal duties is also an offence under insider dealing. So what's covered by the Criminal Justice Act 1993? Any dealings in securities such as shares, debentures, options, warrants, any public sector debt, for example. So these are all, of course, publicly traded securities which are covered by this Act, where we could have an advantage by having insider information. Now, in terms of potential defences to insider dealing, so one defence is that we passed on information as in the normal course of our work, but didn't expect the recipient to deal based on the information. Where our intention was not to make a profit or to avoid a loss would be another potential defence. If there was a new issue that had been stabilised for a limited time underneath the FCA stabilisation rules, where a market maker had inside information in the normal course of their business but acted in good faith for that business. So for example, where they had unsolicited trades, so where people approached them even though they were in possession of the insider trading, they hadn't passed on that information and certainly hadn't suggested to their clients that they should trade. Also where a person only had limited information, so for example that a security would be issued, acquired or disposed of, and therefore it was reasonable to deal. In other words, there was still some risk that the inside information wasn't complete. So penalties here, in a magistrate's course, the maximum that can be imposed is a limited fine and or 6 months imprisonment. But if it's tried in a Crown Court for more serious offences, of course, there's an unlimited fine and up to a 7-year jail sentence for the more serious cases. Now, market abuse, of course, insider dealing is an example of market abuse, but other forms of market abuse are specified under the FSMA, the Financial Services Markets Act of 2000. Now, this actually came into effect as an addition to the FSMA 2000 in July 2005. So as well as insider dealing, misleading behaviour, distortion of the market, dissemination of misleading information, so ramping up securities by broadcasting inaccurate information, so manipulating the market via spreading negative rumours and then shorting the market or vice versa. So this has been something that hedge funds have been accused of in recent times. Improper disclosure of inside information, again that of course fell within our insider dealing rules. Any misuse of inside information, of course, as we saw just now. And also manipulating transactions, so giving a false or misleading impression. Again, this is coming back to similar sentiments to what we were discussing earlier on with regard to clear and not misleading information being provided. Now, market abuse itself is actually a civil offence, not a criminal offence. There may be separately a criminal offence under the Criminal Justice Act of 1993, but this is a civil and separate offence under which people could be tried, and it could end up with a statement being issued by the FCA and or a fine. The Bribery Act of 2010 replaces a lot of old laws relating to bribery. So there are four offences here. Paying a bribe is to induce a person to perform a relevant function or activity improperly or to give a reward for doing so. So receiving bribes to perform a relevant function or act. Bribery of any foreign official. And the failure of commercial organisations to prevent bribery. So in other words, not having sufficient checks and balances in a company's processes to prevent bribery from happening. So what do we mean by relevant function or activity? Well, any function of a public nature connected with a business. Now, improper performance would be where we're judged against the expectation of a reasonable person in the United Kingdom. So irrespective of whether we're talking about bribery of foreign officials, it's what standard would be expected in the United Kingdom which would hold sway. So if there's failure to prevent bribery, then this is where someone associated with a commercial organisation, including their agents and third parties, bribes another person intending to obtain a business advantage, and the company can't show that it had adequate procedures in place to prevent bribery from happening. So the penalties here are severe. Individuals up to 10 years in prison, and companies an unlimited fine, in fact.